Well, welcome everyone to another edition of the NatCon Australia podcast. My guest today is Ian Fletcher, who's one of the leading academic critics of free trade in the United States today. Ian is on the advisory board of the Coalition for a Prosperous America and is the author or co-author of many books, including Free Trade Doesn't Work, The Conservative Case Against Free Trade, and most recently, Industrial Policy for the United States. We chat today about what trade policy is likely to be like and his view what it should ideally be like under the new Trump administration. We cover issues that haven't been given much consideration in the press, at least in Australia, such as the role of currencies in the new trade regime, the problems with industrial policy, even for those that are sympathetic to it, and how they might be avoided, and also how Australia should play things with respect to trade and industrial policy going forward. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Well, welcome Ian Fletcher to the NatCon Australia podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
No problem. Hey, we're about a week out from the inauguration of President Trump. Personnel is policy. Who, in your view, are going to be the key players in the Trump administration when it comes to trade? And what happened to Robert Lighthizer?
Well, it's the same question you asked Andrew Hale, and I think most of what he said was correct. I'll give you a little bit of my own spin on it. I was actually making notes for an article on that subject, so let me just pull that up. I can give the accurate details. Okay, the first thing is with regard to Bob Lighthizer, he is a great guy. He did a superb job in basically neutralizing the World Trade Organization. I haven't the faintest idea about his career path or what he wants to do or why he's doing what he's doing. I mean, by all means, write to him and ask if it's such an interesting thing. We heard a lot of things about battles inside the administration for who got what job. I think he was connected with that. I mean, he did what he set out to do. Maybe he just feels like he accomplished his mission and gives someone else a turn. I don't know. Yeah, anyway, in terms of...
Go on.
In terms of the larger issues, the big question for the coming Trump administration is going to be industrial policy, which is the subject of my new book, Industrial Policy for the United States. And the reason is that Trump changed the course of American policy by turning protectionist after 2016. Joe Biden, despite being on the opposite side politically, kept most of those policy changes and then upped the ante with the largest civilian industrial policy initiative since the Great Depression. So the United States now has huge industrial policies for military hardware, for pharmaceuticals, and for environmental protection. So I like to say the U.S. has no problem doing industrial policy if it's about protecting you from scary foreigners, bacteria, or hurricanes and wildfires, which we have right now in California is burning here as we speak. So the problems that prompted Trump and Biden to make these huge policy shifts and to make them stick, they haven't gone away. The United States is still facing deindustrialization, climate change, the Chinese challenge, the broad decline of U.S. manufacturing. And we've had some success pushing back at that, but Trump is going to have to decide whether to embrace a full-scale industrial policy in his next term, covering all of American manufacturing. He said he prefers tariffs as a policy tool over subsidies and tax credit, which kind of implies just sticking with the narrow tariff strategy. But the fact is that industrial policy is based on only one policy tool, and there are several dozen, don't tend to do very well. I mean, Trump said when he was attacking the CHIPS Act, a podcast, he said, quote, you didn't have to put up 10 cents. The U.S. is spending tens of billions to get this chip manufacturing back. He said, you tariff it so high that they will come and build the chip companies for nothing. So I don't think it really works that way. We're going to need, in addition to tariffs, things like the subsidies, the loans, tax credit, government procurement, and government executed or government funded development of broad-based technologies. The other thing that's almost certain to pop in the next administration is currency, because if Trump wants a flat tariff of, say, 15%, and the US dollar is overvalued by 15%, then the tariff is just neutralized. And that means that the US needs to do what a lot of countries do, which is to manage their currency to maintain the balance between their international competitiveness for their exports and their ability to buy at the lowest possible cost the imports that they need. And the only way that you're going to be able to manage the dollar in the long run at a high degree of potency is to do something about international capital flows into the U.S. You'd have to tax them, because it's all the money flowing into the U.S. for investment purposes. It's puffing up the dollar way above the price that would produce balance trade, which is why we run this huge trade deficit. Now, that is going to put Trump in a collision course with Wall Street, because Wall Street loves free international flows of capital, because that's what their business model is, moving capital around to wherever it gets the highest return. That's what they do.
Yeah. Look, the reason why I asked that question again on personnel is because, you know, Robert Lighthizer at least did have his book and had a long history of explaining the problems with open borders trade. And it seems to me that there are only so many people in the United States, and a far fewer, if any, in Australia, who have that trade critical perspective, a thoughtful trade critical perspective. They're not coming at it from a communist or a Marxist perspective. They're coming at it from a conservative, from the conservative side of things. So I'm just curious, you know, Trump says, talks about tariffs and the most beautiful word in the English language and stuff. When listening to him, I can tell he's read or at least spoken to people who are well-versed in this stuff. But do you have any idea what he does read or who he does talk to when it comes to trade? Have you had conversations?
I have a good idea about that. In the new administration, we already know some of who's going to be there. One person, Peter Navarro, who was in the previous administration, is going to be Trump's special counselor for trade and manufacturing. He's a guy I know. I was in his movie, Death by China. He's a former business school professor with a PhD from Harvard. He knows his stuff. He is a bit of an exciting personality, but some people are. In terms of other people in the administration, there's going to be Stephen Moran, who is going to be head of Council of Economic Advisors, which is like the president's private think tank for policy. He actually comes from the Wall Street side of things, so I don't think he's temperamentally or by professional experience inclined towards tariffs, but he seems to have embraced them purely on their merits. Who he said, for example, tariffs, quote, are pretty effective if wielded smartly. So I think that's going to be a big difference for the first term, where Trump just didn't have a lot of staff to do the things he wanted to do. His winning was a great surprise. He didn't have the retinue that most longstanding political figures have.
I read an article where it said, you know, Don Jr. Did a search on Amazon and Peter Navarro's name came up when they were looking for people to staff the administration with views on China and trade and how to deal with it. I don't know whether that's true or not. I've read his books, Peter Navarro. I actually reviewed them for the Australian, which is a mainstream publication here, main Broad Street, a national broadsheet here. But I feel like at the moment we're sort of seizing on to sort of comments that particular individuals give to a news outlet And you can't point to a sort of larger body of work to anticipate the way in which policy will be formed. Is that fair?
There are a number of larger bodies. We'll talk about that in a minute. But continuing with the theme of personnel, since you asked, the incoming Treasury Secretary is going to be Scott Bessent, who is another Wall Street person who seems to have grasped the policy necessity. He says, quote, industrial policy can undoubtedly contribute to U.S. economic growth, though we need to be wary of putting too much stock in its effectiveness. Speaking as someone who just wrote a book on the subject, yes, you can't be naive about industrial policy. It's not a magic wand. There's also Secretary of Commerce Howard Lutnick, who is going to be running the department that runs the CHIPS Act, which is the big multi-tens of billions dollar push that's now going on to bring back to the United States the manufacturing of the most advanced computer chips. So he's on board with this agenda. And you also have Jameson Greer, who is going to be running the U.S. Trade Representative Office. He's going to have Lighthizer's old job. He was, I believe, Lighthizer's chief of staff. Anyway, he thinks much the same way that Bob did. And of course, we have the famous Elon Musk, who is going to be co-running this so-called Department of Government Efficiency. He has criticized certain ideologically liberal parts of the CHIPS Act, principally things that had not a lot to do with industrial policy per se. But he hasn't damned it outright. He's a technology entrepreneur. His company consume vast numbers of computer chips. So he appears to be a supporter of at least the high-tech industrial policy agenda.
Right. I mean, let's talk about industrial policy then. Industrial policy can be done well and can be done poorly. How can it be done poorly?
Well, in the book, we had several chapters which are about failure cases, because one of the things that struck me when we sat down to write this book is that everybody who writes about it and argues for it, they don't talk about the failures, which is understandable from a polemical point of view, but it leaves something to be desired in terms of intellectual honesty and in terms of winning credibility with your readers by showing you're not naive. But most important was to demonstrate that industrial policy, when it fails, which it certainly sometimes does, it doesn't fail because it's an intrinsically bad idea or because no government can resist the political temptations to corrupt it. It fails in the four countries we looked at. We looked at the UK, Argentina, India, and then France is a kind of half and half case, half success, half failure. When you look at what the British did, because remember, Great Britain in 1950 was the world's number two capitalist economic power after the United States, had the world's largest exports of automobiles, the second largest airplane industry, right down the list. And now they've declined to British exports of something like 1.5% of world trade. When you look at the policies they imposed, they didn't have a strategic plan that was wrong. They had a bundle of what were basically ad hoc responses to individual crises in companies and threat of lost jobs. And they didn't even try to do anything coherent. If you want to have an industrial policy that works, you need to have a clear idea of what the free market is going to do, a clear idea of what it is not going to do that you want, namely bring your nation into possession of the most valuable industries, the ones with the greatest profits that can pay the highest wages and so forth, and a clear idea of how government can push your economy further in that direction than the market on its own. And this leads to coherent strategic views, which the Brits just didn't have. India was a socialist country. They tried to have some capitalism, some industrial policy for that. They also had no strategy. They had no idea of how this was supposed to be pushing the country up the economic food chain, which is what they did have in places like Korea, Taiwan, Japan. Once you figure out what the logic of it is, there's a very sharp distinction between people who know simply what you're trying to accomplish and people who don't. I mean, the Indians had all sorts of strange ideas, like you can't have large-scale textile production because it's going to put individual village weavers out of work. I mean, okay, maybe it does, but there's no way on God's earth you're ever going to get a modern economy if that's the choice you make. And then Argentina is just kind of a black comedy of bad mistakes and general government misfunction. The interesting case, oh, I'm sorry, do you want to talk?
I was just going to say, I mean, talking about Australia, the current government has launched something called the Future Made in Australia policy, which is industry policy. I'm not sure whether you're familiar with that or that policy. It's kind of... Yeah, it's kind of meant to be, although or not the same scale, a replication of the Inflation Reduction Act, or at least modeled along the same lines. I mean, so for Australia, but what we haven't done is changed our tariff regime at all. Is it possible to have industrial policy without tariffs?
Well, the thing is that the big difference between the US and Australia, the US is a gigantic continental economy that, with the exception of products like bananas, is pretty much capable of being self-sufficient. In fact, in the years just after World War II, it has been described as the most successful autarky in economic history. Australia is a small country, or medium-sized, how you want to classify it, that has both advantages and disadvantages. The advantage is that you don't have a lot of mouths to feed. If you created 5 million high-paying jobs in Australia, your worries are over, because that then supports local jobs, because most jobs are just money being recycled through the economy, food, housing, you name it. The United States, 5 million jobs might save California. It's not going to come close to saving the country. The downside is, as a small country, you don't have the option of aiming at just retreating towards more self-sufficiency on the assumption that if you start to do that, you're going to have the market make rational decisions to relocate some things back to being produced in your country that you want, like cars and computers and so forth. You pretty much have to be open to the rest of the world, both because your market is too small to produce, for example, to support a company producing computer chips on the cutting edge, which is what Australians want when they buy an iPhone, okay? The other thing is, if you're going to make money as a country, which you're certainly capable of doing, you're going to have to export. And in order to export, you need access to other people's markets, which means they're going to expect some kind of access to your own. Now, in terms of the specific tariff question in Australia's case, I know enough about Australia's history as a country to know that up until the 1970s, it was largely a tariff-protected economy, and that coincided with an era where Australia had, contrary to mainstream economic theory, the world's highest or nearly highest standard of living. So that's something you have in common with the U.S. I also point out to people that back when the U.S. was a tariff-protected economy, somehow we were mysteriously the economic envy of the world. So there's got to be something to this policy. Now, if you put in a tariff now, I very much doubt that you're going to get Holden Motors back. I mean, if you'd been more strategic about that, it might have survived, but that gets into details. The issue for Australia is, far as I can tell, correct me if I'm wrong, what Australia is doing right now is it's simply riding on the back of huge non-renewable natural resource exports, which have enabled you to pay for all the imports you want, but you're not doing it by manufacturing anything. And you basically become a resource colony for China.
And others. And yeah. I mean, the main, we are probably one of the most open economies in the world in terms of trade. And like you say, we're a trading nation, although we used to be an industrial power with a much smaller population. We used to produce cars and even planes and other things too, amazingly. I mean, it seems beyond the realms of imagination now to think that. But we, in the 80s, cut all our, you know, dramatically cut tariffs and then cut them basically to zero. And so at the moment we have a trade relationship with China and a trade, free trade, so-called free trade agreement with China, where almost 100% Chinese manufactured goods can come into Australia duty-free. There's been no restrictions placed on electric vehicles and other things, like even the Europeans and others are thinking about. And at the same time, we have this new industrial policy called the Future Made in Australia, where we're spending a huge amount of money to get involved in things like critical minerals and other whiz-bang technologies like quantum technology. And the government is going to sort of pick winners in that. And, you know, that's industrial policy, but I've written and others have agreed that it's sort of you're either going to go in all together or not, because if you're throwing a huge amount of money at particular policies while allowing China and others to send in their manufactured goods duty free, you're just undercut. You're not going to be able to have any undercut where any industries you're trying to reboot up. And I think the same dynamic is going on in the United States, although, as you say, it's a much bigger market, much larger population, and can, you know, there will be a cost to tariffs at some level, one would think, but you'll be able to absorb a lot internally. We're pretty self-sufficient, though, all the same in Australia, or at least we were. I mean, there's not a lot of things that we need to import. We've got a lot of resources. We've got a lot of, you know, we used to produce a lot of stuff that ourselves, probably at a higher cost than we can get overseas, but with the quid pro quo that we have internal resourcefulness in industry, which employs people and has all the other benefits, which I'm sure you're, you know, well aware of. So the question, I guess, going forward is for us, and what I'm kind of interested in your thoughts of, is how does Australia play this new trade regime which Trump will seeks to introduce? What should we be doing vis-a-vis the United States?
Okay,
and others.
You got to get back to basics. What you're trying to do, if you have an industrial policy and a tariff regime, you got basically two concerns. The first thing is you should exhibit balanced trade. So your currency is probably overvalued to be running a chronic trade deficit as you have. You also do not want in the long run to be dependent on exporting massive quantities of things like coal, which are environmentally unsustainable for the world, and eventually nobody's going to want it anymore. And iron ore, I don't know how soon that runs out, but there's a problem with being an exporter of resources. So you want to shift your exports to things you make. You want to be an exporter like Germany or Japan, where they export things they make, which also creates more high-quality jobs locally. Now, in terms of the other part of industrial policy, in terms of Future Made in Australia and the relation of that to tariffs, if you're trying to start up an industry in Australia based on local demand, say, for example, that somebody has an idea for a solar-powered cuckoo clock, and you're going to make this and you want to build up the industry, build up your production capacity, establish technological superiority on the basis of domestic demand, and then export them around the world, which brings in all this money. If that's the case, then you're absolutely correct. You do need a tariff to protect your local market. If you're going to use your local market as a springboard to get an industry off the ground. Now, the history of this is that countries with very small economies like Singapore that didn't really have enough of a local market to launch industries based on local demand, they've generally not been protectionist, or they've been very selectively protectionist. They've focused all their efforts on being export competitive. Now, the fact is there are plenty of export competitive countries that have high wages around the world. Japan ceased being a cheap labor economy a very long time ago, for example. If you have a position in sophisticated high-value industries, you can afford to pay first world wages, which is what you want. It's the only thing you should be aiming at. The first thing you need to remember is that when you hear of people in China working for $2 an hour or whatever, the gap in wages contracts the further you go up the economic spectrum. I mean, obviously, tycoons in China and Australia have the same amount of money. Professional people there are still cheaper than professional people in Australia or the US, but the gap is not so large because to get to that level, they need all sorts of expensive training using first world implements in college and computers and so forth. So it is possible as you penetrate these industries that demand higher quality of more skilled labor to be competitive as a first world country. And that's what I think Future Made in Australia needs to focus on. The thing that I don't like about the program is it seems to be framed as if the primary issue is net zero. Now, climate change is a very legitimate thing, and we can talk about that another time. But what you're basically asking about, and what my concern in the book is industrial policy whose purpose is to achieve prosperity. You can have industrial, we already have industrial policies in the US big time for national defense, public health, and environmental protection. We don't have anything whose purpose is simply to raise the average wage. And it looks to me like the genuinely high-tech parts of Future Made in Australia, which I'm not familiar with in great detail, they seem to be add-ons to a fundamental agenda, which is environmental. So that is where I see a gap in strategic intent.
Yeah. I mean, look, I think, and I'm familiar with the kind of mindset, and it's not that dissimilar to what you find in the United States. They recognize since the Trump election in 2016, there are new issues that need to be considered, in particular with respect to China, trading with China. Yeah, it's an issue. We need to rethink this. But they don't change their ideology, really. They just do additional carve-outs for sort of defense and medical gear. There's been no true reflection, unlike yourself and others, from a first principles basis about whether free trade makes sense, right? And they're very hard to sort of penetrate or get them to rethink things from a first principles basis. And I like to not use the term protectionism, but talk about like trade realism. You know, you got to deal with the world as it is and the trading partners as it is. It does matter who you're trading with, not just that you trade in the abstract. On a more specific question, though, like the U.S., I think your ideal industrial policy, one of its many components, would be having a low U.S. dollar, combined with high tariffs and then a sophisticated industrial policy. Is it possible to keep the U.S. dollar down? Because it's risen dramatically against the Australian dollar and a basket of other currencies since the tariff proposals, since the Trump election and since how do you propose to do that in practice?
Well, you got to remember that during the 19th century, which was the last great tariff era, most of the world that counted economically was on the gold standard. So you don't have any issues of currencies being pushed around by imposing tariffs, which is indeed an effect. If you want to manage the value of your currency and you're in the position of someone like the United States, you have to get serious about international capital flows because the logic is pretty simple. When you trade with a foreign country, you either have to give them something in return that you produce today, something that you promise to produce tomorrow, or something that you did produce yesterday, unless you're trading with Santa Claus at the North Pole. Now, when you give them something you produce today, that means just straight exports, raw materials, agricultural products, manufactured goods, television, movies, you name it. When you give them something you produced yesterday, that means you sell off existing assets. For example, some German pension fund gets a share of a shopping center in San Diego or whatever. when you give foreigners things you promise to produce for them tomorrow, that means going into debt, right? So there's no way around that equation. And if you want to bring down the dollar, what you've got to worry about is the international flows of capital, because that's what's pushing the dollar up above the price that would have misunderstood mainstream economic theory, that currencies automatically balance. And this is kind of baked into a lot of trade economics. It's empirically not true. And the reason is that when you import things, you can pay back foreigners with things you produced yesterday or promised to produce tomorrow. So they're not current exports, they're asset sales or they're debt. Now, if you choke that off, you can gradually force your trade back into balance. And the way you choke it off is not through an arbitrary and draconian one-shot deal, but you impose a tax. There was a proposal in the U.S. a couple of years ago. It's called the Baldwin-Hawley bill. Yes, Josh Hawley, and Tammy Baldwin's the Democrat from Wisconsin. Basically, what it would do is it would impose a small but variable tax on foreign purchases of U.S. assets, which means that if foreigners want to buy treasury bills, shares in IBM, real estate, or accept debt from Americans, they have to pay 1% or 2% or whatever tax. Now, you can adjust that tax to the point where it doesn't become so outrageously attractive to invest your money in U.S. capital markets, which are the largest in the world, the most sophisticated, the most stable, protected by the rule of law, generally have access to some of the best investment opportunities. The U.S. investment system is open to outsiders in a way that a lot of countries, you have to be a crony or you don't get anything. So that's why we're sucking in all this capital from the rest of the world, which in a reasonable amount, it would have its benefits. When you start sucking it into the point where you've puffed the dollar up to, it was last estimated to be 16% overvalued, well, then you have the problems that I just talked about.
I'm just wondering, Ian, whether unlike, say, the 19th century, where the US had its tariffs and was you know, seizing market share from Britain, and Germany was doing the same thing with tariffs and industrial policy, whether it's possible now, given the centrality of the United States to the global trading system and financial system, to implement the same type of tariff and regime without causing all sorts of damage to the global financial system. What do you think of that?
Well, I don't think you get anything terrible to happen if you do what you do gradually and with rational strategic intent. Before Trump was elected, we heard over and over again that if you impose tariffs, you're going to get an out-of-control trade war because there's going to be tit for tat, then there's going to be tat for tit, and things escalate until, before you know it, world trade has collapsed. Well, we did raise tariffs, and that didn't happen. I actually predicted that it wouldn't happen in my previous book, which is called Free Trade Doesn't Work. I said, people talk about trade wars. History gives no example of any such thing. I wrote that nearly 15 years ago, and I have yet to have anybody cite, oh, what about the Brazilian-Colombian trade war of 1854 or the Norwegian-South African trade war of 1969. No, they don't exist. There are no trade wars in history. I was never able to discover one, and neither is anyone else. What happened when the U.S. imposed tariffs is that our counterparties responded. I mean, they certainly responded, but they responded in the measured fashion normal in commercial disputes, like, you know, one company raises its prices to its customer, raise a price to a supplier. It didn't spiral out of control. And I think we can count on that so long as the United States doesn't do anything grotesquely stupid. I mean, obviously, if you go looking for trouble, you can find it. But if you were to say, okay, the U.S. ought to have a 15% tariff on all its imports, and we're going to phase it in 1% in the first year, just so you know we mean it, 2% in the second year, 3% in the third year, and so forth. That gives you a gradual ramp up, which means you don't produce a sudden shock, which above all will upset financial markets, because financial markets have asset prices that people depend on, but those assets are not, those prices are not propped up by any firm law or physical fact. They're propped up by the fact that that's what demand for those assets is. So you can have a stock market crash or all sorts of things you don't want if you make too many sudden moves. But if you give companies 5 years to relocate supply chains, there are very few factories you can't build in 5 years, particularly if you have your act together. There are issues in the United States with local control of land use that have interfered with doing that. Interestingly, India has the same problem. I don't know how it is in Australia, but here, because of the federal system, the most significant part of American federalism is not the federal government and the states. It's the power of localities where individual jurisdictions can basically say, you know that computer chip factory you wanted to build because it's essential for national security. Otherwise, all our fighter jets are going to have computer chips riddled with spyware from the Chinese government. Well, you can't build that here because we little town council say so. So that's one of the, that's actually a big issue here. I don't know how it is, as I said, in Australia.
Yeah, there's a lot more. One difference in states compared to Australia that I've come to appreciate is that because a lot of the towns control the police force and the fire department, there's a lot more local city control rather than state control over some things which are state issues here in Australia rather than city issues. Anyway, interesting. So you would want less capital flows than there are currently heading into the United States as a means of reducing the US dollar. What other countries, not a trade war, but a financial, why they, in response, depreciate their currencies to try to continue to undercut and get some type of commission?
The interesting thing about managing your currency in this way is that if any other country tries to do the same thing, it actually reinforces the effect rather than retarding it. And so I'm not worried about retaliation against efforts to bring the dollar down. It's actually a fairly robust fact. I looked at this in some detail, that when a country is subject to attempts to manipulate its currency relative by some other country, where the dollar has, in addition to the problems it has from capital flows, for many years, China was manipulating their currency down against ours. Even a relatively small, not that powerful country, because they own the currency, they can, if you want to push it down, you can always push your currency down. If you want to push your currency up and claim that, you know, like the Soviets claimed that one ruble was worth $1, and I traveled to the USSR and taxi drivers would exchange 7 rubles per dollar. If you're trying to push your currency up, you can't. If you're trying to hold your currency down and other people don't want you to, you pretty much win. And I can give examples of that. For example, during the 1970s oil crisis, when there was all sorts of chaos around the world, a lot of investors wanted to park their money someplace safe because America didn't seem safe, Europe didn't seem safe. So they said, okay, how about Switzerland? Well, Switzerland is generally regarded as a safe place to park one's assets. So they start buying all these Swiss francs. Now, the problem is Switzerland is a very small country. It has, you know, roughly as many people as the San Francisco metropolitan area. Okay. As a result, this demand for Swiss francs started to push the Swiss franc up. And despite Switzerland's reputation as a finance and tourism center, it's actually one of the most industrialized countries in the world. They produce not only watches, which are the kind of the glamorous part, but they produce fine chemicals, precision machinery, and a lot of other things that the German-speaking countries seem to specialize in, which are desperately important, you've never heard of, and extremely hard to make. And they had to choose, basically, between their financial sector, which, like financiers everywhere, is pretty much always in favor of free flows of capital because that's their job, and their industrial sector, which employed a lot more people and was more important for their long-term well-being. And although the bankers didn't like it, the Swiss imposed restrictions on incoming capital flows so that their industries wouldn't get priced out of the market.
Is it better then, if I'm understanding you correctly, that is it? Do you foresee a situation where you get to much more managed exchange rates amongst peers, where there's an annual meeting, and there genuinely is a discussion about where every state, or at least allied state, should be able to hold its currency with respect to the other?
Well, there are two examples from history of managed exchange rates. There's the gold standard in the 19th century and early 20th century, and there's the Bretton Woods era after World War II. There are any number of problems with both, but particularly if you're looking at Bretton Woods, because gold raises all sorts of issues of its own. The Bretton Woods era from 1944 to 1971 was one of the longest episodes of broadly shared economic growth around the world and across social strata in all of history. In some ways, it's a golden age. The French refer to it as les 30 glorieuses, which means the 30 glorious years. Mm-hmm. So a managed exchange rate regime during which trade deficits were very, very tiny, if they existed at all, can be very effective. The issue, of course, is who's going to impose it? The U.S. had the muscle to impose Bretton Woods in 1944 as World War II was winding down, because at the end of World War II, the United States was more than half of the entire world economy. For a brief moment, it peaked at just over 50%. There's no country today, not the U.S., not China, that has anything like that kind of power. So what I would say, that instead of a managed exchange rate regime per se, what you'll get if the United States gets serious about managing the dollar down, which is going to force all sorts of other countries to make various adjustments, and they're going to, you know, jockey for their own advantage. And the outcome of this from a game theoretical perspective, I think, which is a way of, using a mathematical or computer model to say, okay, you have everybody fight it out. Where does it end up? Where it probably ends up is everybody would maybe like to run a surplus and not run a deficit, but they can't. So you end up with everybody adjusting their exchange rates until you have, I would be prepared to bet, as a falsifiable empirical hypothesis, you have a radical reduction in gross trade deficits all over the world. Now, naturally, one country's deficit is another country's surplus, so the aggregate is always going to be zero. But right now, you have huge and unsustainable trade deficits in the US, the UK, Australia. India also has this problem, certain other countries. And I think these are going to come down if you have a situation where the U.S. gets serious about managing its exchange rate, which will have the knock-on effect of everybody else is going to do it. And I think you're going to reach a kind of equilibrium where it's understood by all the players that it's impossible to steal an advantage against everybody else because they'll just respond to block you. So you end up with a kind of gentleman's agreement or what have you, that interest rates are going to be at a certain level, and they will change over time as national competitiveness changes, as you have inflation differentials between countries due to different domestic policies. But I would expect a reasonably stable outcome if the United States embraces active management of its currency.
And isn't that what floating exchange rates are meant to do automatically, though?
But you see, the problem with floating exchange rates is, remember how I told you about how you pay foreigners for your imports, right? You either pay them with exports, things you produce today, selling off assets, which is things you produced yesterday, or with debt, which is things you promise to produce tomorrow. Now, if assets and debt sales did not exist, if the only thing you could pay other countries for imports was exports of your own goods, Well, yeah, then it would be almost impossible to run a trade deficit of any size. You couldn't run a trade deficit larger than the amount of foreign cash you had on hand. And in that world, yeah, floating exchange rates do automatically adjust. The problem is we don't live in that world. Since Bretton Woods collapsed in 1971, and progressively after that, the various limits on international capital flows were repealed, you now have all this capital sloshing around the world and pushing currencies up and down, pushing trade positions in and out of balance. It's not hard to see why. So no, floating exchange rates won't give you that.
Interesting. But moving back to tariffs, I mean, what goods, if any, are you more comfortable allowing other countries to produce for the United States?
Well, one of the great breakthroughs I had when thinking through these issues when I first started about 15 years ago, a friend of mine pointed out to me that if you put a 25% tariff on imports to the United States, you're not going to bring back production of t-shirts to the United States, because the cost of a t-shirt is mostly raw materials, which are pretty much the same anywhere, and cheap unskilled labor, which is much cheaper in most of the world than in a developed country like the United States. So you're not going to bring back the t-shirt industry. You quite likely would bring back production of cars, aircraft, computers, things like that. And you know what? Those are the kind of industries you ought to want in your economy. So there's a chapter in my first book. Hang on, I'll get you a copy. Basically says that a flat tariff on the economy doesn't have flat effects. It has different effects on different sectors. And if you're a developed country in the position of the USA, it's generally going to bring back the kind of industries that you would want. So in terms of things that we would be wise not to produce here that would actually make us worse off if we did, anything that's made overwhelmingly with unskilled labor, anything that's made from raw materials that aren't producible in the United States, you know, banana, rubbers, rubber is mostly synthetic now anyway, but it was a big issue in World War II. Particularly if we have multiple suppliers for those goods, so we're not subject to some political crisis resulting in supply being cut off. And the interesting thing is, at the time of the COVID pandemic, there was a shortage of masks. And a mask, cloth mask, paper mask, seems like a really simple thing, a very humble item. But it turns out that producing an N95 mask requires special weaving machinery, which you can only get from a limited number of suppliers who have like a 2-year backlog to sell you a weaving machine. So you can potentially discover that all sorts of ordinary things are critical. So you ask yourself, can we stockpile this? Can we get it from multiple suppliers? But I'm by no means advocating that the U.S. become an autarkic economy. The conventional logic of free trade doesn't justify free trade, but it does justify trade. There are definitely ways in which we're better off because we can buy things abroad rather than produce them here.
Yeah, right. But how do you actually make that determination? Because whether, you know, whether the United States should produce masks or whether they should produce shoelaces or these things which you would think in obviously in peacetime there's less of an issue, but if you needed I was reading an article and it was talking about how in Texas, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, how they were having trouble sourcing like nuts and bolts or something, or coat hangers, some really basic thing which you think it would be very easy to produce, but there's been such a hollowing out of industrial capacity that they were struggling to produce even that. So how do you make the determinations about those on those questions?
What I would do is I would first set out to revalue the dollar so that we balance our trade overall, and then apply a flat tariff of some percentage, which will start to separate the sheep from the goats. Then I think you work from the top down and you say, what are the most critical things that we really should be producing in the United States? And national security answers a lot of that question because, you know, you can't defend your country with websites and financial transactions. You can only defend it with machines, which are generally large, noisy, and made out of steel or aluminum. Okay? So you obviously have to be able to produce aircraft, vehicles. You have to be able to produce the electronics, all sorts of other stuff. You have to be able to produce steel. You have to be able to produce all the other key metals. Australia is in a bit of a different position here because your national security posture is not to be a superpower. It's to be a good friend to a strong country. It used to be Britain and now it's the United States. It's a perfectly rational strategy for you. And after you've looked at the national security stuff, you look at public health. You don't want to be dependent, as the US has become and as Australia has become, on pharmaceuticals sourced from China and India, particularly because there are quality issues with both. They don't have the same standards of quality control that would be required in a developed country. And China is rife with just outright corruption where people, they're not even trying to make good medicines and failing, they're engaged in outright, you know, gangster stuff. But after that, you want to look at which industries have the high value added per man hour and can support high profits and high wages. So you're going to ask yourself, why is it that the United States doesn't have a shipbuilding industry? Because if you're talking about sophisticated shipping, not the low-end stuff, but if you're talking about sophisticated shipping, like building cruise ships and, you know, the liquid natural gas tankers, the kind of stuff that today is built in Japan, which is by no means a low-wage country anymore, well, why is that not being built in the U.S.? And I don't know if that's a specific point. But the point is that it's not really much of a secret where the cream of the crop of industrial activities is. And that's how you identify it. That's not actually the part of future policy that I'm terribly worried about. I don't think it's going to be that hard to tell. For example, right now, there are fusion energies on the horizon. There's a gigantic fusion reactor being built in the south of France by an international consortium called ITER. And there's a small company in Boston in the US building a much smaller reactor with newer technology called Commonwealth Fusion. They say it's going to work. And in a year or two, we're going to find out if this is so. If this happens, do you think the ability to produce fusion power reactors is a high value industry, or do you not? Do you think it's rational to be indifferent whether people have jobs doing that or jobs waiting tables in a restaurant? That's not a difficult question, I don't think.
It's not, I guess, in the broad, but it's very hard for really sophisticated, you know, venture capitalists to work out which whiz bang technology is going to win in a particular industry. And in my experience, government officials aren't anywhere near as good. They don't have the same type of experience. So how do you counter that problem, or how do you overcome that problem where, I think economists, the public choice theory problem, where once the government gets involved, it kind of, and makes choices and tries to pick winners, it incentivizes things that wouldn't have otherwise got ahead. And there's always the possibility of corruption and similar problems. How do you, I mean, I'm sympathetic to all this, as you can well tell, but that's a legitimate concern that, you know, more free market economists make. How do you reduce the that type of effect?
Your concerns are absolutely valid, and I hope people never forget them. But you're not talking about picking technologies. You're talking about picking companies. Venture capitalists don't generally pick technologies. Everybody knew the internet was the new frontier. So the question then is, which company do you back? Do you invest in Yahoo? Do you invest in Google? Do you invest in eBay? Do you invest in Webvan? Do you invest in whatever? those kinds of company-specific decisions, there's not much reason why a government should be involved in that, because that layer of economic decision-making can pretty clearly be handed over to the market, and it should be. But when you're talking about key technologies, like the U.S. would be much better off today if the government had seen 10, 15 years ago. For example, under George Bush, there was this program called the Freedom Car Program, which is a big bet on hydrogen-powered automobiles. Okay, that has not panned out. Okay, if they had said, okay, maybe hydrogen is going to work, maybe what we really need instead is just to improve battery chemistry so the batteries become more productive. And maybe that will work. And we don't know at this stage, but you adopt a portfolio approach. And if you'd done that, okay, you spend $1 billion on pursuing this hydrogen thing that doesn't work out. But then you also spend $1 billion on pursuing the battery thing, which very much did work out. And now you would have a gigantic industry producing electric car batteries in the US, where we're currently very dependent on imports. So the portfolio approach is key. The technology level is key. You don't pick companies, you pick technologies. And when you pick technologies, you pick a portfolio of different approaches. Sometimes the government does this. I mean, there are a bunch of different ways to deal with the problem of CO2 emissions. One of them is so-called carbon sequestration, where you kind of wring the stuff out of the air and turn it into something you can bury and become harmless. Nobody knows right now how well that's going to work out or how well the different approaches to that are going to work out. We don't even know if carbon sequestration in the long run is going to be important. But when you have a portfolio approach, the worst that can happen years later is you spent billions of dollars to research a bunch of approaches. Some of them didn't work out, so you lost that money, but some of them did. And when it does work out, it's spectacularly profitable. I mean, the amount of money spent developing the internet relative to the amount of money that's now been made on the internet, there's no comparison.
Yeah. Just switching tax slightly, in the United States, there's new think tanks and people like yourself who have written books, and I'll certainly drop those in the show notes, who are thinking critically about trade in ways that the traditional think tanks, yeah, that's another one, I've read it, like Heritage and AEI and others, I'll drop them both there, haven't. And although they claim, like Ian Hale, the guy I spoke to at Heritage, to have now reassessed their thinking, you know, I certainly remember 20 years ago, Heritage was not thinking critically about trade with China and many other people. In Australia, there's, I honestly, apart from this, my humble little sort of think tank that I've set up, I don't think there's anyone really that's taking a true critical approach or a reassessment of trade. You're an economist. Did you start off always with this particular mindset, or how did you change your thinking?
In 2007, when I sat down to write my first book, Free Trade Doesn't Work, I went looking for that book on Amazon, figuring I wanted to hear the case against free trade, because I was seeing the United States supposedly doing everything right, and yet it had all these problems. So I'm like, what's going on here? And the book wasn't on Amazon. The best book I actually found was by an Australian called Graham Dunkley. I don't know if you know the name. His book was probably the best book I was able to find criticizing free trade, but intellectually rigorous, but kind of narrowly focused. So if I'm going to read this book I want, I'm going to have to write it myself. So I was able to get some support from a friend of mine who was running a now defunct think tank in Washington, and I had some philanthropic support by various means. So I was lucky enough that because it was an empty topic that hadn't been seriously considered in a long time, people were willing to let me, who's not a PhD in trade economics, have a shot writing a book at it. And the thing I discovered is because there had been so little serious thinking, I was largely in virgin territory. I mean, I kept tracing arguments where the last time somebody wrote a paper on a particular issue was in the 1930s. I kept digging this stuff up. And then, honestly, when my book came out in 2010, for about the first month that it was out, I was terrified that I would suddenly get an email one day and someone would say, I've looked at your book, nice try, but you're wrong because of X. And I would look at X and I would say, oh, I guess that refutes everything I've said. I was terrified somebody was going to come up with some killer argument on the other side. And that never happened. And the rest, as they say, is history. The entire country has now become skeptical of free trade.
Yeah. I mean, you had people, well, Bob Lighthizer was skeptical of trade, I think, in the Reagan administration to some extent. And you had people like Pat Buchanan and others and that, the paleocons who are always critical about trade in some respect. But it certainly wasn't mainstream and in the way that it has now become, this new thinking on trade. And it wasn't actually, the rethinking wasn't driven by the intellectual class. It was driven by, you know, people reflecting their preferences at the ballot box for people that realized that there were problems going on and expressed them in their different, sometimes sort of slapdash type of ways. I do think there is, and I really appreciate your book and I really appreciate the work that you do, because I actually think it's, people need to move on from like arguing about whether their free trade isn't the best answer in all circumstances and working out, getting into the nuts and bolts about how a country like Australia reacts in this, you know, in this new trade realist world and how it engages with the United States and what it actually means. Because it's all very, as I often finish these podcasts, I always ask people, how can it all go terribly wrong? Because it could go wrong, right? It could be the case that Trump interacts policies which are ill thought through. It's all, you know, we've got to be America first and this, that, and the other. But it's poorly executed. There is corruption. You don't get the results which were intended because the policies were poorly designed. I mean, how in your view, could it all go wrong in the United States and elsewhere?
Well, let me just begin by saying that having thought about these issues for years and years, the biggest problem is not even corruption. It's just uncertainty, because I get asked by people all the time, what should we do about such and such? And I've written a book setting forth economic history and setting forth general principles. When you try to decide what to do, you are inevitably forced to make judgments about the future where you just don't know. For example, right now, the United States is facing a huge bet on Intel to bring back production of the highest end computer chips. Now, Intel just stumbled and they just got rid of their CEO. So it's not going that well for now. I have no idea what happens ultimately, but it's hypothetically possible that we ultimately discover that Intel was the wrong horse to have bet on, and we have to do something else. And that's not a mistake that you make because industrial policy is a bad idea or because it doesn't matter if the most advanced computer chips are made on this little island that's going to be overwhelmed by our enemies very soon, or let alone the people are corrupt and stupid. The problem is there's just a lot of things you don't know and you can't know, which, as I said, brings you back to the portfolio approach that I mentioned before, which is the normal, rational way that human beings, particularly in economic life, manage risks. Now, in terms of how everything can go sideways, if Trump lunges into very aggressive, emotionally driven policies, you can screw things up. I don't think he will, because you got to remember, when Trump was elected the first time, everybody said, he's a fascist, he's a wild man, he's a maniac. And the average U.S. tariff in the first Trump administration went from 2% to 3%. Okay, that's not the action of an extremist. Now, it went from 3% to 19% on Chinese goods, but that's a different case. Anybody can see that China needs a different treatment. And the tariff increase didn't turn out to be inflationary. We've documented that at Coalition for a Prosperous America, which is the organization that I'm on the advisory board of. And the other reason I don't think that Trump is going to kick over the apple cart, so to speak, is if you look at who he's hiring for the new administration, he has access to a much higher class of educated, experienced, policy savvy people than he did the first time, because he's had 4 years to assemble people who are interested in him. There's been a whole lot of intellectual and policy change in the meantime, so a lot more smart, experienced people are willing to consider these kind of policies. And the other thing Trump has done is that he's hiring people on, for example, both sides of the tariff debate. For example, as I mentioned, Stephen Moran is going to be the head of the Council of Economic Advisers, which is the presidential think tank. But there's also something called the National Economic Council, which is more like a war room for actually getting people together to implement policy. And that's going to be run by a gentleman by the name of Kevin Hassett, who is much more of a skeptic of tariffs. And then we have a gentleman named Russell Vought, or Vought, who in Trump's first term proposed budget cuts that Trump himself rejected. He's a budget cutter. He's a fiscal hawk. And serious industrial policy is going to cost money. And Trump has said things that make me believe that part of the way he functions is you get two people side by side in your office and you make them debate in front of you. And that's how he gets to weigh the two sides and make a decision, because Trump, whatever else he may be, is probably not an idiot. And he knows that if he does something stupid and causes a stock market crash, for example, he's going to get blamed and he's not going to get all the things he wants. So I think Trump has the motive and the means to keep policy on the rails. I got to say, he's going to be facing a very challenging environment, because you've got not just the things that he cares about bearing down on him. You've got Cold War II, a possible hot war. You've got all the questions about U.S. military presence around the globe, which has a lot to do with our relations with foreign countries, which is naturally part and parcel of our trade relations with foreign countries. I mean, the reason the U.S. has free trade is because of the Cold War. That's why we opened up our markets to the rest of the world. There was no point at which we decided it was bad economic policy. So I don't envy the position Trump has put himself in. I'm quite confident that another year or two, Biden is going to be sitting back in his rocking chair, laughing his head off at all the problems that have come down the pike.
On the, as you well know, the proposal has been for a 60% plus tariff on Chinese goods, higher on particular items, and then this broad-based across the board, I think it's 20% tariff. So for Australia, we have a current account deficit with the United States. You know, the US sells us more than it sells, we sell it, unlike China. We sell, I'm chatting to people here, I mean, we sell wine to the United States, which would have an impact if there's a 20% tariff on wine in the United States. Likewise, things like lamb and also there was aluminium and other types of refined, which we were able to get exemptions for in the past. I know this is hard to kind of and it's, to guess what will happen, but do you think it's likely that there will be exemptions for those type of things, or more or a broader exemptions for allies like Australia, like we were able to achieve last time?
Well, if you look at the exemptions that were granted in the first round of Trump's tariffs, there were two kinds. There were exemptions granted to American companies that couldn't source a particular item in the US at all. And there were negotiated agreements with various foreign countries on, for example, steel. Now, it's absolutely true that being a friend of the United States puts you, in the geopolitical sense, puts you in a better position than you would be if you were an outright adversary like Iran or a flaky country like Brazil that doesn't seem to know which side it's on. Sure, that benefits you. But the real issue is going to be the economic issues of the trading relationship. The countries that got special deals on metals trade were countries that had agreed to regulate their exports, countries that were not running huge and problematic surpluses. If the Australian foreign minister goes to the United States and says, look, we're running a deficit with you, you run a surplus with us, we're clearly not taking advantage of you, we're not blocking our markets, we're not manipulating our currency, we're not playing all the corporate mercantilist games that happen in places like Japan, Korea, China, et cetera, et cetera. You're in a strong position to say that merits giving us an exemption, because if nothing else, it's a signal to other countries that if you play fair, like Australia plays fair, well, then maybe you'll get an exemption too, which is exactly what the United States wants. But it's going to be driven by the specific economic behavior. I don't think it's going to be driven simply by the geopolitical fact of being friends with the US.
But just, I mean, that it does, to my way of thinking, mean a kind of boon for lobbyists who are willing to argue the case for a particular industry in Washington, right?
Because that's it does. But the current regime has been so ridden with lobbyists, so ridden with a dozen different kinds of corruption that one, it's not like we don't have that problem already. The other thing, which in fact we talk about in the new book, when we look at the history of America's tariff era in the 19th century, one of the questions we asked was this a hopeless mass of political corruption? And it turns out that there probably was some corruption, but a lot less than you think for a couple of reasons. The first thing is that the laws on what was illegal in those days were much laxer than they are today. So most of what happened in terms of lobbying, it wasn't necessary to break the law to agitate for what you wanted. Okay, so it's not corruption in the strict sense. The other thing is it was not really possible to simply buy a protective tariff on your industry with campaign contributions, for example, because whenever you propose a tariff on an industry, it activates a whole complex of special interests. The suppliers to that industry have a position on it. The consumers of that industry have a position on it. If you put a tariff on steel, all the real estate developers who build steel skyscrapers with millions of tons of steel beams, they're not going to want their prices to go up. They're going to be politically powerful. Automakers are going to say, well, we're a consumer of this product. We're going to lobby against the tariff. As a result, the tariff regime was generally kept pretty middle of the road by the fact that if you raise tariffs too high, it upset too many people. If you set the tariff too low, it didn't do any good to the protected industry, and it didn't raise enough revenue to be meaningful on a revenue basis. If you set a tariff too narrowly, that is protecting only a small subset of products, you couldn't get enough people to vote for it on the floor of Congress. If you set a tariff too widely, affecting too many products, that attracted too much opposition from consuming interests. So I don't mean to be Pollyannish about it, but the historical evidence suggests that if you put tariffs in play, you're going to get a kind of rough equilibrium fairly soon, particularly because people know what the scam is. There are lots of people out there who will accuse you of imposing a special interest tariff contrary to the divine wisdom of David Ricardo, and theory proves this, that, and the other thing, even if you're not doing it. So anything people try and do on tariffs, the opposition is on a hair trigger to fight it, which is what you want. You want controversy. You want well-supported intellectual capabilities in terms of congressional staff, in terms of NGOs, think tanks, universities, and so forth, who can actually give you facts and arguments on things. So I think there's going to be a lot of controversy, and I believe there will be a reasonable equilibrium arrived at. The one thing that can disturb that, of course, is if you have crazy political outcomes due to non-economic events. If one party or the other self-destructs electorally by taking stupid, unpopular positions on other issues, which is not out of the question, either in American history or if you look at the present day Democrats and Republicans, well, you could get one party stuck in power. That interferes with the checks and balances of a democracy. So yeah, you can generate scenarios of things going pear-shaped, but that's not my expectation.
Yeah. Well, look, Ian, I'm not going to keep you any longer. I've really appreciated you getting making the time. And if there's any message which comes through loud and clear, that there does need to be a reassessment on trade in Australia and the United States and elsewhere, and it does need to be done in a thoughtful, sophisticated way with people who have considered both sides of the matter. I'll direct people to your books in the show notes, and look forward to keeping in touch, because it will be very interesting times as we in trade and in other areas as we enter the Trump administration. Thanks again.
Well, thank you very much for having me on your show, and best of luck with the situation down there in Oz.
Great stuff. Thanks.